The Israeli government must do more to significantly increase the flow of aid. No excuses. They must open new border crossings. They must not impose any unnecessary restrictions on the delivery of aid. They must ensure humanitarian personnel, sites, and convoys are not targeted.
Hi, this is Hold Your Fire, a podcast by the International Crisis Group. I'm Richard Atwood. We just heard US Vice President Kamala Harris taking what appeared to be a tough line on Israel's blocking aid into Gaza. In reality, though, the US for months has done nothing like enough to push Israel to allow more food, water, medicine into the Strip or impose costs for Israel refusing to do so. Last week, a UN official warned that a quarter of the people in Gaza were a step from famine. Children are already dying of starvation. With public order breaking down, it's hard to deliver the aid that does get in.
This is what desperation looks like. Thousands of men whose families are going hungry clambered onto trucks delivering food to Zeitoun in Gaza City today. The Israeli Defense Forces have targeted Hamas police, so there's no one to maintain civil order. Aid officials say that by preventing enough food from getting through, Israel has caused both hunger and chaos. In Shifa Hospital, doctors are still treating those injured on Thursday when Israeli soldiers fired at people climbing on a convoy in Gaza City to grab what they could for their hungry families.
The US has started dropping food into Gaza by air. Just this week, the Biden administration announced that it would also start to deliver aid by sea, seemingly a public recognition that it doesn't believe it can persuade Israel to let in enough aid over land. So we're going to look today at what's happening in Gaza and why it's been so difficult to get aid in. We'll do the episode in two parts. I'll be joined shortly by colleagues in Israel and the US, but we'll start with a conversation I had earlier this week with my colleague Azmi Kashawi, who is in Rafah in southern Gaza on the Egypt border. Listeners may remember that Azmi, like many Gaza residents, left his home in Gaza City in the north of the Strip in October, spent some time in Khan Yunis in the middle of Gaza before fighting there forced him and his family further south. Rafah, before the war, was home to about 280,000 people. It now houses perhaps as many as 1.4 million. I started by asking Azmi about conditions there.
People in Rafah, they lack everything. Proper shelters, healthy nutrition food, milk for their children, proper medicine and medical care. But the worst is overpriced goods in the markets by the war merchants. It is 10 times the prices before the war. In a population which was already poor, it became a daily struggle for them to survive. And this is if you survive the daily Israeli bombardment into different areas of Rafah. You can add to that another corner of misery, which people, during the winter, they couldn't find warm clothes for their children. People are wearing the same clothes they gone out with at the first place. Some of the humanitarian aids who came, it has some clothes, but that doesn't cover everyone.
And Azmi, I know a lot of people in Rafah have been in tents or makeshift shelters through the winter. I mean, what happens when it rains?
Luckily, this winter, it didn't rain much. But when it rains heavily, it turns the life of the displaced people who are living in tents upside down, soaking the people, their mattresses, blankets, their food, everything into water. And even the kids sleep inside the water until the next morning. I've seen many of these kids next morning shivering from coldness. A lot of people and the children get sick with pneumonia, problems with their respiratory system, and with the lack of medicine, it turned into more severe illness and spread more into the general population.
And you mentioned, Azmi, the bombing, that although there hasn't yet been a ground operation, Israel is bombing Rafah. How frequent is that?
It's not as much as other areas like Khan Yunis, which we hear the bombardment continuous on the clock. But it happens average between 2 to 6 bombardment in a day and night, killing between 20 to 40 people in average, the majority of them are women and the children, and sometimes the number of people wounded will be by tens and sometimes by hundreds, especially if they hit the crowded area of displaced people, because it's overcrowded Rafah. Any hit, usually it causes a lot of casualties.
And I guess people there know about the threats of a ground operation?
One of the most fears of Rafah is the ground operation. People are fearing one of two things. Either they will be deported or expelled into Egypt. And the second one is to be sent back to the central area or to Khan Yunis area. In front of their eyes is the experience of the Gaza city and the north, where a humanitarian is hardly can reach there.
And do you hear from people in the north, in northern Gaza, in Gaza City? Do you know what conditions are like there?
The situation in the north is much harder. People are starving there. People cannot find things to eat. Some of them, they start eating wild plants, tree leaves. Before that, they eat in animal feed. And the way some of new humanitarian aid, which was dropped by the Jordanian, Emiratis, Egyptians, including the Americans, it's like a drop of the ocean of the needs of people who are still living in the north. Some of these humanitarian aid had fallen into the sea. And this method doesn't provide a just distribution, since a strong one can always go and pick up these aids and prevent the weak ones from having it. That's not a solution. It has to be more organized.
And Azmi, what about the hospitals and the healthcare?
Most of hospitals in the northern Gaza Strip had been destroyed. Shifa Hospital, it was totally wrecked and hardly functioning. Ma'madani Hospital also was hit, and it's about the only hospital which partly receives wounded people. The rest they are taking to another hospital, which also partially working, Kamal Udwan. And there is one medical facility deals with women and pregnant women called El Sahaba in central Gaza. That's about it. These are the only functioning medical centers. They lack fuel for the generator. They lack medicines. Some of these operations are done under the light of mobile flashes without anesthesia. Children have died in this hospital of the lack of nutrition. Often people lose parts of their bodies because they cannot be rescued by the doctors with the materials they have.
And I realize this isn't easy to answer, but do people, I mean, you spoke last time you were on about this, how everybody knows people have been killed, everyone's lives have been uprooted and destroyed. I mean, who do people blame?
People are split about who to blame for what's going on. Some are blaming Hamas for starting it without getting people prepared for such a war. But the majority are blaming the Israelis for taking all their revenge on ordinary civilians. And also they are destroying the life and the infrastructure of Gaza and pushing the people towards displacement, pushing them to leave their all their life behind. Also, people blame the whole silent official world, you know, who are not doing anything to prevent the Israelis. Also, they are blaming the Arabs of not really helping out their Palestinian brothers, you know, by putting more pressure to stop this unjust war. So all these fears make people blame so many different parties for what's happening to them.
So we'll turn now to the second part, which is my conversation with Myrav Zonshine, Crisis Group's Israel expert, and Rob Bletcher, who is Crisis Group's Future of Conflict director, but for years was our Israel-Palestine director. And I should say that we recorded this before the Biden administration's announcement that it would deliver aid to Gaza by sea. Myrav, Rob, welcome back on.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
So we'll come in a moment to living conditions in Gaza, some of the stuff that we just heard from Azmi, famine risks that the UN is warning about. But let's start with the status of the last round of ceasefire talks in the Egyptian capital, Cairo, which ended some days ago without an agreement, but still this hope that maybe they can get something in place before Ramadan, which starts next week.
Right now, the talks are stuck, and they're stuck because the two sides have essentially different purposes in a ceasefire. Hamas wants a ceasefire to end the war. They want a ceasefire to be the first step in a clear process toward ending the war. And Israel has a different goal from the ceasefire. It wants to get its hostages back, and it wants to be able to continue the war afterwards. If both sides were willing to compromise, you could imagine a certain zone of agreement between the two of them. Hamas does not want to give up the Israeli hostages that it holds without an end to the war. So one could imagine that Hamas releases a certain number of hostages, 40 has been discussed, in exchange for a temporary ceasefire, and Israel accepts to receive back less than the full number of hostages in return for a temporary ceasefire. But that's not how Hamas has played it. They have been consistent in their demand for an end to the fighting, withdrawal of Israel from Gaza, and a return of Gazans to the north, the areas from which they were displaced. And even though they have indicated some flexibility in terms of timing and sequencing, they have not really deviated from those demands. We've heard a bunch about differences over how many prisoners would be exchanged for how many hostages.
These are Palestinian prisoners that Israel would release like it did last November in exchange for the hostages. And there's some discussion about which prisoners, whether those jailed for more serious crimes, and discussion also about the numbers.
Precisely. I think on these numbers, there's probably room to fudge. I think it's the essential differences that are really getting in the way.
And Myra, how are the talks and the lack of progress viewed in Israel?
There's obviously a lot of frustration. The families of the hostages have stepped up their pressure. They've been marching from the south to Jerusalem. They've been doing a lot of different things, not necessarily that effective. There seems to be some kind of apathy in the Israeli public about the hostage deal, and at the same time, a frustration that it's not happening.
And within the Israeli cabinet and government, so there's a war cabinet that includes Benny Gantz, who is a rival to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who actually just visited Washington this week to Netanyahu's dismay. Plus, there's Netanyahu's governing coalition with religious parties, two far-right parties. Are there differences either in the war cabinet or in the governing coalition?
There are sharp differences in the war cabinet. Benny Gantz and Gadi Eisenkot, who come from a rival party, they have positioned themselves for several months now since the first hostage deal, coming out to say that this is the priority, that this is the most urgent war objective, and that the destruction of Hamas can come incrementally in time. And Gadi Eisenkot even came out in several interviews in the last month or so, saying not only that military force is not what's going to bring the hostages out, but he implied that he doesn't trust Netanyahu, and basically expressed what many in the Israeli public feel, which is that Netanyahu is making decisions on this war and on the hostage deal specifically based on his own political survival and not based on what's actually the best thing to do for the Israeli public and for the hostages specifically. As far as the far-right parties, now Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, who are the far-right ministers from the settler nationalist sector in Israel, they are not in the war cabinet. They are in the normal security cabinet. They are very open about the fact that the hostage negotiations should come to a halt and that Israel should go into Rafah as soon as possible. So they've had a very hardline stance. There is a public and a base that they cater to who agree with them. But this is not something that's really reflected in the way that the decisions are made in the war cabinet, primarily because the people in the war cabinet, Netanyahu included, are dealing with pressures from the U.S., and they understand more than the far right, you know, that ideology can't be the only factor in making these decisions.
So let's turn then to what's happening in Gaza. And I guess there's different elements to the humanitarian crisis. As sort of we heard from Azmi, there's the sheer numbers killed and injured. There's the collapse of the health system, the difficulty of getting life-saving aid in, the public order challenges. And we'll try to unpack some of that. But maybe, Rob, you could just start by sort of summing things up.
Yeah, the humanitarian situation in Gaza is, you know, as the world has come to know, is about as grim as it gets. And I think that that's one of the most painful things for people in Gaza, that they know that the world knows how bad things are. Yeah, the numbers now, it's over 30,000 killed and more than 70,000 wounded. When it's, I think most people estimate that that's a considerable underestimation.
And why do people think that it's an underestimation?
It's an underestimation both because there remain a lot of people buried under rubble that simply have not been recovered, but also because there is what people call excess mortality, meaning that people are dying from lots of things that they would not die from otherwise if it weren't for the war.
And we heard a bit from Azmi about the hospitals, but also foreign doctors that have been in and come out to tell these sort of almost unimaginable stories of kids coming in with serious injuries, no painkillers, no morphine, insufficient beds, children dying on hospital floors. What's happened to the health system?
Well, in terms of a professional medical system, it's basically collapsed. It has collapsed. In the north, the hospitals have been reduced at best to sort of, I don't know, advanced first aid, maybe in some cases treating the acute malnutrition. The government reports that I think it's up to 15, 18 now, children that have died from malnutrition and dehydration. In the south, there's one hospital that's functioning more than others. It's the Emirati Hospital that's run by MSF, Doctors Without Borders. But also Gazans are now reporting that they're afraid to come to the hospital because there have been, you know, any number of attacks on hospitals. Israel says it's because Hamas uses the hospitals for military purposes. But just last week, a number of tents in front of the Emirati hospital were hit by Israel, killing some number of people. And so Gazans are now reporting that they're afraid to come to the hospitals.
And Rob, the food shortages we heard up top just last week, a UN official warned that a quarter of Gaza's population is one step from famine. And what does that look like?
It's worse in the north, where people are starving to death. People go for days without food. Some flour has gotten in over the course of the past week, but we're in a situation where these incremental differences do not make a huge difference on a societal level. And once you start seeing the starvation that we're seeing, you at a certain point get to a very rapid drop off when you hit that famine level, when you hit that mass starvation level. And once you hit that point, it's extremely difficult to reverse. It requires intensive process. It's a very specialized medical regime. And even if the food drops have gotten a little bit of food into Gaza, Gaza as a whole is still marching toward that cliff. And, you know, in a way, I think a lot of the food security community hesitates a little bit when people talk about famine is looming, because that kind of de-emphasizes how bad things are at the moment in the service of how bad things could get. So I think we need to keep in mind both how horrible things are right now, but also the enormous catastrophe that could be right around the corner if we hit that steep plunge.
And Rob, I guess that's the backdrop to this incident last week with the aid convoy that went into the north. There was a sort of rush for food and more than 100 people were killed, according to observers and the health authorities in Gaza. They were mostly shot by Israeli soldiers. According to Israel, people mostly died in the crush. But either way, the context is one in which people are desperate for food, and in which there's a lot of chaos in the way it's being delivered.
Yeah, that's a good example of how there are different elements to starvation. So part of it is that there's not enough food and other essential goods getting in. But part of it is that public order at this point has broken down to such an extent that even that the food and supplies that are in Gaza cannot be adequately dispersed. There was a breaking point maybe about 3 weeks ago now where Israel targeted civilian police from the Gaza government, killing up to about 9 of them, including the head of police intelligence in the Rafah region.
And these are best understood as Hamas local police?
I think the way that most people in Gaza understand it is that the more senior officials within the Gaza police, at least at some point, had a tie not just to Hamas, but probably to the Qassam Brigades, to the military wing. You know, those were the people who were most trusted with weapons and the regulation of public order. I think that most people think that once these people go into the civilian government, their ties to the military wing on a professional or collegial level, they probably still know people, but the focus of their professional activity becomes civilian order.
And these police were escorting the convoys because you've had this breakdown in order and gangs and others try to get the aid and, you know, sell it on the black market or control it in other ways.
Yeah, that's been happening. So that incident in the south were a number of civilian police. They were protecting aid. And what we saw in the incident that you asked about as the aid convoy was moving north, in this particular instance, it was Israel that was ostensibly protecting that convoy. But when the convoy was mobbed by crowds, and, you know, Israel claims that some of the troops felt threatened, and so opened fire, killing a certain number, Israel acknowledges, but Israel says many more were killed in the stampede. I'm not sure exactly why this debate is about how many were killed for what reason is so important, right? Your two choices here are that Israel has created a situation in Gaza where people are so desperate that they die in a crush to get food, or people are so desperate that they're willing to die in a crush to get food and Israel shot some of them.
And Rob, just so we're clear, because you do hear quite a bit of anger directed at Egypt as well, but the main problem is that Israel's not letting in the aid, right? In February, I think even less got through than in January. Top US officials, really senior US officials, say they spend vast amounts of time persuading Israeli officials to let in individual trucks. And now, as we heard up top, the US has felt it needs to airdrop aid in because it can't persuade Israel to let in enough overland.
There's been plenty of foot dragging, inefficiency, lack of capacity in Egypt, but you're 100% correct. Egypt is not the reason that Gazans are starving. Gazans are starving because Israel is blocking access for aid and otherwise not facilitating its distribution. Israel says there's no limit on the aid that can come into Gaza, but in practice, there's really nothing but limits. It takes up to 2 hours to inspect every truck. If there's anything on the truck that isn't allowed in, the entire cargo of that truck is sent back. The list of what is allowed in and what's not allowed in at various points has included things like canned goods, because the metal supposedly could be used to make rockets, or scalpels for doctors, or tent poles for the lots and lots and lots of tents that all the displaced people need. The list changes frequently, or it's like not even so much that the list changes, it's that the application of the list changes frequently. Like different guards will let in different things on different days. And then once the aid gets in, it has to be dispersed, which is impossible if Israel refuses to coordinate its military operations so the aid can pass, or when Israel shoots at aid convoys, as aid officials themselves have told us. And then, of course, there's the breakdown in public order that has played a big role as well. You cannot run a humanitarian operation in chaos because it's the strong who end up with the goods, and what the hungriest and the poorest need ends up instead in the market being sold at exorbitant prices.
And Myra, among Israelis, among the Israeli public, how much does the suffering in Gaza or the outrage in much of the world at the suffering in Gaza, how much do those resonate?
Well, since the start of the war, the levels of death and destruction have not really resonated or been mediated properly to the Israeli public. Obviously, there are Israelis online who are consuming all kinds of news, but unfortunately, it's just not a factor in how Israeli domestic politics are playing out. I think there's consensus for the war, for removing Hamas from power, and that continues to be quite strong. And I think a lot of Israelis have a very firm belief that the IDF does its best to avoid civilian casualties. And it doesn't matter how many rounds have proven otherwise. That's just what Israelis believe. And I think they are being confronted with the fact that the world and Biden now and Kamala Harris are starting to express frustration with the fact that things are going this way. There are elements within the Israeli security establishment, former and current officials and the army itself, criticizing the lack of a political vision or a strategy or a plan for Gaza. So there are those voices coming out and saying, we warned you that if you didn't have a day after plan that this would happen. So there is that positioning, which is mostly political positioning against Netanyahu and against the current coalition.
And Myra, what is the debate about aid? You hear the argument a lot in Israel that, you know, Hamas is diverting aid. I don't think that there's any evidence that Hamas has been diverting aid that's been delivered by the UN, at least. But you certainly hear that argument that actually there should be less aid going in until Hamas releases the hostages, for example. Is that still a debate?
It's still a debate, and you actually have protests by the crossings in Israel in the south. There was one day where they managed to not allow any trucks to go in. These are mostly right-wing activists. They tend to try to identify themselves as part of the families of the hostages. I'm not sure how much that's true, but there is this notion that how can you provide aid to Gaza? And Israelis believe that that aid also helps Hamas to remain intact. And so you do have that feeling in the Israeli public, and then you have it very clearly expressed by the far right, which is saying don't give any aid whatsoever. But you still have those voices in the government that this is something that needs to be used as a bargaining chip, that we can only provide humanitarian aid when they are providing hostages. So this is very much part of the discourse here.
And Myra, last time we spoke, and something that others have written about as well, but the sense still of not just Israelis' perceptions that their security has been shattered by what happened on 7th of October, but also the sense of trauma and the lack of space for sort of reckoning with, or lack of space for sympathy for what's happening in Gaza, the sort of trauma being all-consuming. Is that still the right way to describe it?
Yeah, it's absolutely the right way to describe it. There's just no room for that right now. And the fears and the worries and the concerns are being compounded by the mistrust in the government and the calls for elections increasingly, but also wanting Israel to win because they want to feel like there's security, that Hamas is fully removed. So there's just almost opposing sentiments. But again, once you've had the October 7th attack with all of the looting and the rape and everything that happened, so for them, it's, you know, that price was so high that for them, the price that Gazans are paying are really Hamas's fault. That's how they see it. It is Hamas's fault.
And just before we move to sort of what's happened to Hamas and the military operations, just Rob, what have been so far the implications of the cuts to UNRWA's budget, to the UN Relief and Works Agency budget after the, I'm sure as listeners know, Israel made these allegations that some UNRWA staff members were involved in the 7th of October, that a number of UNRWA staff members were linked to Hamas. As a result, a bunch of Western governments, including the US, have cut off aid. What has been the implication of that so far?
Well, right now, UNRWA only has a few more weeks left before they're going to not be able to pay salaries anymore unless somebody steps up with an enormous amount of money. The governments that cut off aid, that aid comprises about 70% of the budget. So even if some of the aid is replaced by other sources, they're going to have to dig themselves out of a deep hole. So by the end of March, certainly by April, you could see UNRWA operations starting to wind down, which will have disastrous implications because in Gaza, the humanitarian infrastructure is UNRWA infrastructure. So even the other agencies that are there, WHO, or certainly WFP, they use the UNRWA infrastructure to deliver their own goods and services. And thinking a little bit longer term, UNRWA also does things that nobody else could do, such as education, vaccines. There is no other agency which is set up to take those over, because I very much doubt that Israel wants to do it.
So let's talk then about the military operations and how far they have managed to degrade Hamas's military infrastructure. So there is still fighting, from what I understand, in Khan Yunis in the center. The Rafah operation for the moment is on hold. It doesn't seem that Israel actually has the troops on the ground to be able to do the Rafah operation for now. And in the north, Hamas fighters units popping up and shooting at Israeli troops. What are the official lines from the Israeli security forces about how much of Hamas has been destroyed now?
Well, the messaging has been disjointed and incremental. They basically come out with statements about, you know, last week we killed this many Hamas militants, we destroyed this tunnel or that tunnel. But these are all tactical achievements. And they also are claiming now that I think about 13,000 Hamas militants have been killed. So that's maybe half of the force throughout the strip, if we think about it being 30,000. So this is what the IDF puts out. And then at the same time, you have these TikTok videos of soldiers doing all kinds of looting and kind of atrocious things. And so it just feels very disorganized, to be honest. And whereas in the first months of the war, I feel like there was a concerted effort at building a victory narrative of some kind or having it kind of ready to go, at this point, I don't really see that. I see a lot of small statements and then kind of the constant rhetoric by Netanyahu of a total victory. It's actually quite surprising when you think about how much the IDF invests in the image and in the branding of what it's doing.
And a few weeks ago, we talked about this, but it still seems to be the case that none of the senior leaders in Gaza, the senior military leaders, have been killed or captured. There was, the one Hamas leader, Saleh al-Aruri, West Bank chief, was killed in Lebanon, but none in Gaza. And even it doesn't seem clear that much of the level just below the top leaders that Israeli operations have killed, plus, you know, at best half, according to what the Israelis say, other estimates, I think even US intelligence estimates are much lower, of the fighters in the various Hamas brigades have been killed.
Yeah, it seems like the best Israel could hope for at this point is that they'll be able to destroy Hamas's semi-professional military structure. It's like hierarchical fighting structure that allows it to operate with some kind of command and control and in an organized fashion. But even Israeli military intelligence, just like U.S. intelligence, they've already concluded that the war is not going to end with the complete destruction of Hamas or even the complete destruction of their military capacity in the sense of being able to operate as a guerrilla force. So even if Israel does end up going into Rafah and doing damage to the Hamas battalions or brigades that are still kind of organized, I think you can expect to see a future that looks something like the situation in the north, where you don't see Hamas operating with, you know, many tens of militants operating together. But you do see continued attacks that are costing the lives of Israeli troops.
The other aspect to destroying Hamas's military infrastructure is, of course, this vast tunnel network. And it seems, even by Israel's own accounts, that although they've destroyed a lot of the shafts of the tunnels, but there's very little sign that the actual tunnel network itself, is hundreds of kilometers, has been dismantled.
Yeah, I mean, I think the fact that the military publicizes these occasional videos of them destroying tunnels, after a while, it feels like the accretion of anecdotes that raise suspicion that it's not adding up to anything systematic. So they've had certain successes, but I think the government has been fairly open about the fact that they were surprised once they got into Gaza by the extent of the tunnel network. And it's Israeli military analysts who have been saying louder than anybody that they're not going to be able to destroy the entire military infrastructure as Israel originally had hoped to do so in the very first phase of the war.
And so the potential for a ground offensive in Rafah, I mean, there's two ways to understand this. One is that the Israeli threats to move into Rafah are partly aimed at getting Hamas to accept a temporary ceasefire deal closer to what Israel wants. But on the other hand, top Israeli officials, Defense Minister Yoav Gallant said it just the other day, they're explicit they need to go into Rafah because they say that's where the last intact brigades of Hamas are. You know, sometimes they say that's where Hamas leaders are. So for Israel, whether it's in the coming days, whether it's later, they still feel an operation in Rafah, at least if you believe what they're saying, is necessary.
We've been hearing about this for weeks. Any military person you speak to will say, of course, we need to go to Rafah, especially because I guess Hamas is concentrated there. Although Israel was talking about how the leadership was in underground in Khan Yunis. So, you know, I don't actually know. But it's very hard for me to see how Israel would end the war without going into Rafah. But at the same time, the troops that have been working nonstop for months in Gaza have been released, and they might be called up again, and we don't know if they'll be stationed in the north or in the south, north meaning on the Lebanon border. But there's been a reduction of troops in general now, and I think they've been pushing this rhetoric a lot because of the hostage deal ceasefire talks. It's hard for me to assess whether that has worked as leverage. It seems like it hasn't on Hamas, so it could definitely happen at some point. I just don't see it happening now.
So let's shift then to US policy. And we heard up top Vice President Kamala Harris adopting quite a different tone, not really saying anything very different, but saying it in a different way, much more feeling for the suffering in Gaza, sounding tougher on Israel than Biden tends to. And yet that comes, you know, again, as we heard up top, as the US is starting airdrops because it can't persuade Israel to get enough aid in over land. So what should we make of prospects that the US uses the tools it has, whether that's conditioning military aid, other forms of pressure, to push Israel toward a ceasefire? And of course, it's not just Israel. Hamas also not compromising much, as you said earlier, Rob. But what prospects for a stronger US line?
The temperature of the conversation in the U.S. and within the administration has certainly increased. And you can see that there's a lot more frustration that U.S. entreaties are not being listened to when the Biden administration feels like it has, you know, offered wall-to-wall, virtually unconditional support, that when it asks for something, Israel's not doing it. There's a political, domestic political dimension where the temperature, you know, got turned up a lot after the Michigan primary, where it became clear that the Gaza war could be costing the Democrats a lot in the next election. But there's no indication that the fundamental dynamic has changed. Ever since the beginning, the U.S. has used exhortation in order to get Israel to change its policies. It's talked to it. It's urged it. It's reasoned with it. Now the tone is a little bit angrier, but so far there's no indication, at least any public indication, that there would be a consequence imposed. And I think something like the airdrop is, you know, more or less a public admission that the U.S. has been unable and will be unable to move Israel on the humanitarian front. There are basically three things that matter to Israel. It's weapons, it's money, and it's a veto at the Security Council. There are probably certain other things that the U.S. could do that would impose some kind of cost. But it seems like right from the beginning, there have been some in the administration who have wanted to impose that cost. But the people at the top, especially Biden, has not been wanting to do that. And even if Biden sounds angrier today, that remains the case.
And there's another idea floating around that maybe President Biden could either, together with some of these other measures you're talking about, Rob, or even absent those, take an even stronger public position, maybe even go to Israel, to the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, speak over the head of Prime Minister Netanyahu, actually much like Netanyahu himself did some years ago when he came to the US Senate and opposed the Iran nuclear deal. So Biden would speak directly to Israelis, to Israeli legislators, stress how much harm the war is doing and that it's not going to make Israel safer over time and that it's time to wind things down to get some sort of a hostage deal. I have to admit, it seems for now a stretch that Biden's going to do that. But if he did, Myrov, how do you think it would go down? How would it play into Israeli politics?
So, I mean, there's kind of a split in Israel. There's those that see Biden as the person who has made the hostage release a priority, and they would welcome him here, and they want him to put pressure on Netanyahu to get a hostage deal in that sense. But there's also the Israelis, the way that it's framed here, the U.S. airdrop and the pressure now, you know, increasingly put, is seen as like they're basically just blaming Netanyahu for endangering the U.S.-Israel relationship. And then there's also the segment of the Israeli population that sees Biden is just now very concerned about his reelection, has domestic, you know, issues and international pressure. So he's trying to like kind of play it both ways. But I think overall, it depends how he would do it. But I think if Biden was able to create a ceasefire that did release most of the hostages, that most Israelis would support that. And I think also Israelis want Netanyahu out of power. So when he embraces Benny Gantz, that's something that I think a good chunk of the population support. I think they would also, you know, in some ways support a pressure from the U.S. to force a deal that could even threaten the coalition, because if the far right doesn't agree to a stop to the war or even a prolonged ceasefire, that could destabilize the government. In some ways, it would be a win-win.
So the U.S. clearly wants to get a temporary 6-week ceasefire ahead of Ramadan, again, cutting it now very fine. And then the idea presumably is that it would build on that, that it would be difficult for Israel to go back to war. There'll be a chance to then sort of create new political dynamics. That is clearly the US plan, whether or not it's doing enough to get there. But there still seems this disconnect between what's actually happening in Gaza on one hand and on the other, the plans that you hear the US, Arab governments and others floating for a day after or a way out. There's different variations of the day after plans, but broadly speaking, they include some form of Palestinian authority, whether it's the Palestinian Authority reconstituted or another Palestinian body holding power in Gaza, that Hamas would acquiesce to that but not be part of it. Israeli forces would withdraw, maybe to buffer zones, more aid would get in, and that would create space for a longer term political horizon, political track, the centerpiece of which would be normalization with Arab governments, with Saudi Arabia in particular. They would normalize relations with Israel in return for Palestinian statehood, or at least a viable track to that. Broadly speaking, that's the direction the US and others seem to be pushing. In reality, though, the way the military campaign is taking things, and in fact what many Israeli leaders, not just Netanyahu, are saying, is nothing like that. It's much longer term. Israeli security control of Gaza, continued military operations against whatever is left of Hamas. Sometimes Israelis now, and Netanyahu himself has talked about clans, so basically Gaza's big families providing basic public order, some elements of governance, humanitarian agencies sort of picking up the pieces. Is that fair, that much of the talk about a day after seems disconnected from what's actually happening? Or are there parts of the Israeli leadership that might be more open to what the US is proposing than appears to be the case from their public statements?
On the political level, I think there's two main approaches. One is the approach that we're seeing now with Netanyahu, which is that he's not cooperating with the US, really. He's not providing a day after plan. We have seen how what has been done in Gaza so far has created a vacuum and hasn't achieved a strategic breakthrough on the war objectives. And then the other kind of opposing view is that Israel should have a day after plan. It should be working with the U.S. framework. There are plenty of former and current security officials who are constantly talking about the fact that a revitalized PA, a Palestinian Authority, is the only entity that can retake the Gaza Strip at some point, and that we must work with the U.S. in order to create, first of all, a hostage deal. For the security establishment, it would be very important to calm things down during Ramadan, also in other areas in the West Bank and Jerusalem. And it would also maybe provide some space and quiet on the northern border. So as far as somebody like Benny Gantz is concerned, and even I think to an extent the IDF, even though they won't say it openly, a ceasefire is, and a hostage deal is the way to go. And then working with the U.S. on a greater plan towards some kind of political process with the Palestinians, and that also includes normalization with Saudi Arabia. That is a track that I think a different politician, somebody like Benny Gantz, would at least pay lip service to. He may not go all the way with it. He may not go through with major concessions to the Palestinians. That's not something that most Israelis are currently ready for. But he certainly would work a lot more closely and in cooperation, I believe, with the U.S. So I do think that Gantz would provide a change in leadership. Regarding the Palestinian issue on a whole, I don't know if there are that many differences between Gantz and Netanyahu. What he would do in power is a question, because he has come out very much as part of the center-right notion that there is no Palestinian state that could be formed anytime soon. But it's possible that if he comes into power, that he would use that position differently. He could also be very similar to Netanyahu. It's hard to tell.
Rob, I want to end by asking you a broader one about US policy in a moment. But just to come back to this question of big Gazan families ruling, which again, Israeli leaders are floating and on the ground, you know, in some ways seems to be the way this is heading. I mean, is that even feasible? Would anyone in Gaza actually assume that role now?
It's hard to see how the idea would work in practice. Israel tried something similar in the West Bank in the late 1970s and early 1980s, working with local leaders in order to try to marginalize the PLO, but that didn't work. And I think you could expect something similar in Gaza. From what we've heard, Israel has indeed reached out to some families, and all except one refused to even have a conversation with the Israelis about it. That could change over time, but however weakened Hamas is, they are, you know, at least now and for the foreseeable future, will be strong enough to prevent an alternative administrative structure from being established. But like even more broadly than that, the idea just kind of seems divorced from reality. Like sociologically, in Gaza, like even the big families, they're not tribes, right? Like they're families. They're big families with some social power that, you know, in some ways, at some times can act, in some kind of capacity as a unit. But the idea that these families could replace a governing authority, or even just like working with local groups when it comes to the families, it's kind of like a fantasy. It's not really a serious idea.
Let's end then with a question on how US policy has sort of ended up where it is. And of course, it's easy to understand why after the horror of 7th of October, as we've talked about many times on the show, the US, President Biden, wanted to back Israel strongly. And to be fair, even in his first trip to Israel, Biden called on Israel not to make the mistakes the US had made after the 9/11 attacks. And maybe, I don't know what you think of this, but maybe in some ways, people felt back then, I mean, even we hear this from some in the region, that Israel's campaign would be less brutal in terms of its costs on civilians, more effective in dismantling Hamas. But pretty early on, it was clear what was happening in Gaza. And the US has been, certainly in the eyes of much of the world, very slow to recalibrate. And some people have argued that actually US leverage is overstated, that actually Israel doesn't depend completely on US military aid. But that seems wrong. And I mean, if anything, the Gaza operation has shown how much Israel does need US aid. And sort of in that light, it seems really a weakness of US policy that it's been unable to leverage that, recognizing all the challenges of US politics. But the approach of sort of strong public support trying to influence Netanyahu behind the scenes has obviously failed. In fact, Netanyahu seems to relish, as Myra has said, confronting, contradicting the US. But do you think, Rob, that there's also been this sort of challenge of, I guess, sort of investment costs, that once the goal was set as destroying Hamas, sort of dismantling its military infrastructure, removing it from governance in Gaza, an understandable goal after the 7th of October in some ways, but not an achievable one, at least not at an acceptable cost. Once that logic was set, it was hard for the US to shift tack, to change course, even as the horror of what was happening in Gaza became clear.
I'd put it this way. The Biden administration has been at least one step behind the reality of the Israeli campaign and playing catch up since the war started. The intensity of the bombing campaign, the displacement of much of Gaza, the Israeli government's refusal to accede on even some of the Biden administration's most basic requests, that's caught the administration off guard. So, and from one perspective, it's hard to blame the U.S. October 7th took everybody by surprise, and so has Israel's response to October 7th. I think if you ask senior officials in the U.S. administration, even on October 7th, whether they thought it was possible that Israel would literally starve Palestinians, I think very few of U.S. officials would have thought that the war ever could have come to this. And it's easy to see how the Biden administration got sucked down the path that it did. Biden is a politician of a certain generation that has certain ideas about the, you know, overriding importance of unconditionally supporting Israel. There are plenty in the administration who really do see the problem of Hamas and want to get rid of Hamas. The domestic politics, of course, are incredibly complicated, especially with the election coming up. And Israel is incredibly important to the U.S. as a regional ally. And the domestic politics in Israel as a regional ally are particularly important when it comes to thinking about what levers the U.S. has to pull when it comes to pressuring Israel. It's easy to criticize and to say merely exhorting Israel is not enough. You need to impose a cost on Israel. But if you're the Biden administration, you're thinking about how to impose a cost on Israel without imposing too big a cost on your administration and on the U.S. So, yeah, it's easy to see that the administration and Biden himself is getting hurt from the left. But a change of direction is going to hurt him in the center or on the right. And also, like, you don't want to compromise on Israel's readiness as a regional ally. So you're not going to start out with cutting military aid, especially with Israel potentially facing a looming war in the north with Hezbollah. But the U.S. could start with other things. Like, the U.S. could start by imposing end user agreements on military aid so that the aid could not be used in Gaza. Or if the U.S. only wants to impose it for Rafah, to stop the Rafah invasion, then they could do that too. Or the U.S. could more narrowly activate any of the usual kinds of policies that would kick in cases like this of extreme humanitarian need and human rights abuses, like the Leahy Amendment. Like you could invoke that just like for a single military unit. You wouldn't have to do it for like the entire army at once. Or if they wanted to stay on the aid, the U.S. could drive pre-inspected aid to the border. There is a Jordanian corridor that has been ready for months, where there's been a pilot project and it worked well. You would take aid in through Jordan and drive it across to Gaza. But Israel has refused to approve the corridor. So the U.S. could put a U.S. license plate or a U.S. soldier could get in the driver's seat and drive it to the border and just dare Israel to stop the aid from getting in. So your question is right. Like, it's hard for the U.S. to shift tack because of the personal politics of the president, because of U.S. national security interests, because of domestic politics, just because of inertia. But there's been a major failure of imagination on the part of the administration, and it's been that way since the beginning. It's a failure to imagine where this could end up from the start, and a failure to imagine what other tools could be brought to bear now.
Rob Marav, thanks for coming on again.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So this is coming out on Friday, the 8th of March. Just yesterday, the Biden administration announced it would build a pier or a temporary port in Gaza, deliver aid by sea, as we talked about up top. But it's not at all clear how long this will take, or more importantly, how the aid will be distributed once it gets into Gaza because of the public order breakdown that we talked about. It will be even more difficult if the UN Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA, stops operating because it's run out of money. Gaza almost certainly will need far more aid getting in overland. You can, of course, find all of our work on the Gaza war on our website, crisisgroup.org. Thanks to our producers, Kevin Murphy, Heiko Schaub, and thanks, as ever, to our listeners. Please do get in touch, podcast@crisisgroup.org, or write to me directly, outward@crisisgroup.org, if you have any questions, suggestions, or concerns. If you like the show, please do leave us a positive rating or review, and I very much hope that you'll join us again next week.